Bender Anderson and Barba PC is in the unique position of being able to offer their clients proven solutions derived from the depth and breadth of their experience. They offer services for homeowner associations in the areas of general counsel, common fee collection and foreclosure, document revisions and amendments, rules enforcement, association borrowing, contract review, developer issues, construction defects litigation, and mediation and facilitation of meetings. Their best practices strategy delivers professional expertise to their clients in the most cost-effective manner possible. Bender Anderson and Barba PC's extensive experience means that they have been exposed to a vast range of problems, which gives them the ability to anticipate problems and offer effective solutions. They promote community and responsible leadership in the associations they serve. We also educate our clients, preparing them to address the challenges of running an association. Call Bender Anderson and Barba PC at 203-248-6440. That's 203-248-6440.
Good afternoon and welcome to Ask the Experts. I'm Brian Forster, and each week on the Talk of Connecticut, I'll have an in-depth conversation with a different member of the Greater Hartford community. My guest today is Ron Barba. Ron Barba from Bender Anderson and Barba. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So, Ron, we're going to get right into it. Got a lot of questions to ask you.
Whatever I can do to help.
So, we're talking about condominium law.
Yes.
So, I've got a bunch of questions. So, first question is, say if you have a board that's very strict when it comes to collecting the monthly charges. Some of the unit owners may have complained that the board should be more neighborly and give slow payers kind of a chance to catch up. Maybe some unit owners have had health problems and should have their debt forgiven. Does the board have the authority to be easier on these unit owners? Why is collecting common charges so important?
Well, I think you hit on probably one of the most important aspects of common interest community life. And without raising those common charges, just like taxes for a town, without those monies, those communities would fall fairly quickly. So there is a statutory framework in place that, frankly, is pretty draconian in its application, and it requires owners of condominiums to pay their monthly charges. So where you have those instances, and I'm fully aware that there, and many of our clients have faced this exact problem, where you've got people that are having real financial hardships, you want to try to be neighborly. But at the same time, you have this, especially the board has a higher responsibility to the corporate body and to the community at large to keep those funds going. And they have to face hard facts about whether or not people can afford to stay in their community. And that's a difficult decision. We spend a lot of our time trying to work out payment plans for people in that circumstance, but even those have to have guidelines. I would say that you can be neighborly, but you still have to, as a board, I think you have to be true to your obligation as a corporate director and make sure that you collect that money. It's not an easy situation. I certainly sympathize with those people in that circumstance, but the corporate health is more important than any individual, and that's a difficult thing for me to say because I respect the individual. Without running on too much, I'd say that this is a very difficult living circumstance for some people, and sometimes you can't afford to live where you're staying.
It's definitely a fine line, understandably.
No doubt.
So, what can an association board do if one of its owners is renting the unit to someone else, and they constantly are just violating the rules and the bylaws of the condominium association?
Oh, you mean the tenant?
Yes.
Well, you know, a lot of times condo boards find that they're faced with a circumstance. It's really more often than you would think. You've got tenants that really don't understand the relationship between the owner and the board and their obligations to their neighbors. So where you have a tenant that just continuously violates the rules and regulations that that everyone else has to follow, the board is faced with a couple of options. Certainly the statute is a guide, but it does provide the board authority to actually evict the tenant if the unit owner won't act to correct the circumstance. And the ability for the association to evict is established by the statute. It also allows the association to go back after the unit owner if they've been unresponsive or unwilling to address the problem to collect the costs of that eviction as part of their common charge. So there is a remedy for those extreme circumstances where tenants just absolutely refuse to obey the rules. They're just as subject to those rules as any unit owner would be.
I guess if you don't have the buy-in from the renter versus the person who owns it, it makes it difficult. You got to make sure you have the right person renting.
Well, you touch upon the real conflict for many associations in terms of the number of rentals you'd really want in your community versus a unit owner occupied. And part of that consideration certainly is the level of investment in terms of economics, but also community investment of these tenants who may be more transient than a unit owner might be.
So if I'm a condominium board and I'm planning on replacing roofing and siding and the complex is about 100 units, there's not a ton of money to do all the renovations, but they're absolutely necessary. They're long overdue. What kind of options are available to the community to meet the needs?
Well, that rain's going to find its way inside eventually, Ryan. That's the reality. And boards are really increasingly faced with this difficulty because when you're talking about capital improvements, you're talking about, imagine yourself as a homeowner. You've got a nice little single-family cape. Eventually, that roof's got to be replaced, and you've got to pay for it. If you haven't saved that money, like most of us haven't, then you've got to raise that money. And the way to do it, there are a couple of options. Certainly, the board can pass what's called a special assessment on its unit owners. And that's like a sort of, you know, when the town assesses your home for the sewers or for the sidewalk or something like that, they charge a little extra to do that work. Well, condo associations have the same mechanism in place where they need to raise money for any particular reason. There are safeguards in the statute to make sure that unit owners understand why the money is being raised and for what purpose and for how long. But the reality is that they are getting extra taxes in their community to raise that money. The problem with that, though, is that it takes time. You can't just, you know, if you've got 100 unit owners and a $200,000 roof, whacking people that kind of money all at once normally is difficult for anybody. So you want to do that over time and spread those payments out over time. So you may make the special assessment due over a 12-month or a 24-month period of time, but that doesn't stop the rain from coming in while you're collecting. So many associations are going to get loans, and they'll go to – there are certain banks. I know Windsor Federal is one that comes to mind, Community Association Bank. There are many. Webster, I know, does some. Milford Bank, I don't want to do their advertising for them, but there are banks that are very familiar with community association loans. They're an unusual animal. They're not the standard sort of commercial loan, but they understand the nature of community association finances, raising finances, and they're fairly secure loans. So you go to a bank like that, borrow based on the project's needs, and then you produce the money and instantly, and then the association pledges their future common charges, those special assessments, for instance, as collateral for that loan going forward. It could be a 5-year, 10-year, 15-year loan. I mean, I've had associations that have done $15 and $20 million capital improvement projects. Well, that's a chunk, and you're going to have to spread that over some time. And many banks that have come to realize just how secure and how beneficial these sorts of loans can be for them are anxious to get into the market. So there's plenty of money out there to be lent. They're secure. I don't think I've ever heard of one of these loans ever being defaulted upon. So that's another way of doing it. There are formalities that the board must go through in terms of pledging that money, getting unit owner support for that. There's, you know, you've really got to invest the unit owners into the project, because if you don't, you know, they're gonna hear is loan, special assessment, and they're not gonna understand why. And a lot of people, you know, need to understand why they're spending the money they are. And boards that are prepared for that sort of blowback, that sort of pushback from the unit owners, are better able to close these things out.
And I'm talking with Ron Barbara here of Bender Anderson and Barbara. So question, are condominium associations, are they subject to fair housing laws in Connecticut?
Oh, they are, and they are very often in the in the bullseye of a lot of fair housing, independent fair housing firms, and certainly the CHRO, the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, Brian. I have to tell you that one of the greatest challenges that we have in representing these communities is educating them about their exposure. The Fair Housing Act is a very broad statutory scheme, and its goals are certainly laudable. The problem with common interest communities is that the boards are largely made up of lay people who aren't imbued naturally with the information and the obligations of a Fair Housing Act. So they run afoul where there is very often we run into the problem where a unit owner or even a tenant will ask for some sort of accommodation for a handicap of some kind, and the board is either slow to recognize that or just out of ignorance denies the accommodation. Very shortly thereafter, we'll see a letter come with a complaint from the CHRO, and that's a whole different matter. Getting tangled up in with the CHRO on fair housing matters never usually works out for the board. So we spend a lot of time educating our clients about the needs, the number of protected classes, race, religion, sexual orientation, family, physical handicaps. There are more, I'm sure I'm going to forget. But the point is that there is a protected class out there, and boards need to be extremely sensitive to requests for reasonable accommodations. Be that as it may, reasonable means reasonable. You know, there are circumstances that are maybe unreasonable, and boards are not required to jump through impossible hoops to accommodate any request from somebody that may be in a protected class. That balancing act is really the art form, understanding what their obligations are versus, you know, where they can say no.
So getting back to the board, so say you have a board and it's made up of seven people, although the bylaws, they say it calls for only five members, and no one can remember why or when the additional two members were added. Could this situation cause any issues with the association?
Oh, sure. The situation you're describing is really one where somewhere along the line, somebody just decided, you know what we could do is we need more people involved. Some unit owner meeting down the road a long time ago said, well, we need more people. This five-member board's no good. Except that the failure to recognize the obligations and the restrictions in the bylaws. You have to understand that common interest communities are built up. They're created by what's called a declaration. That's like the constitution of the community. And then there are the bylaws. Those are the statutes of the community that state how a board is to be run, how meetings are to be held, things like that. And then there are rules and regulations and then policies. So it's sort of like we have here. We have a constitution, we have statutes, we have regulations. So the bylaws, very often, some old declarations have this, but mostly it's bylaws, will define exactly what the number and qualification of board members is going to be. So why such a strict adherence to that? Well, when the boards make decisions, they if they've done everything right, but the board is not duly constituted for one reason or another, then that decision, if it's to enforce the regulations against somebody or if it's to decide to initiate a collection action or something like that, that board decision becomes subject to challenge because it wasn't from a duly elected board, but rather an invalid board. And if the board is not duly, if it's not valid, then their decisions become challengeable and the whole system breaks down. So while it's important to have involvement from the community, if there's going to be a change in the number of board members, it has to be done by an amendment to those bylaws. And that amendment is not a hugely onerous challenge, but it must be done so that the unit owners have some say in it. The board can't unilaterally decide how many members are going to be, and they're not going to be able to decide what the qualifications of those board members is going to be. That has to be a unit owner vote. That has to become subject of an amendment process. So in that circumstance that you read, Brian, it seems to me that they've exceeded that number. And although there is some limitation on the look back on the decisions made by that seven-member board, I would suggest that that particular board revisit the issue. If they want seven, great. Go ahead and amend your bylaws, and you shouldn't run afoul going forward.
So you're just kind of opening up Pandora's box.
you really are inviting real trouble, because all you need is one unit owner that understands what the rules are. And if you've got a decision from that board that they're not happy with and you try to enforce it, you're going to have real problems. And it's going to come down the line when they point it out to a judge and the judge says, you weren't a duly constituted board, so anything you said was invalid. Sorry, take your toys and run away.
And I'm talking with Ron Barba here of Bender Anderson and Barba. So getting into the board. So let's say, I know sometimes they can be kind of contentious meetings.
Yeah.
So let's say I'm a member of a board. It's a pretty large community. Lately, you've had a unit owner. For the unit owner meetings, they've become very unruly. And there's a certain group of owners, and they've kind of banded together, and they seem to just kind of be making trouble, and they're constantly interrupting things. They're just kind of strong-arming owners who want to speak. Some unit owners, because of the behavior, don't even want to go to the meetings anymore. What can you do?
Well, I think the board and your question certainly points out a very recognizable situation. Very often, where you might have a disaffected owner or two or three, they tend to gather and they create this sort of cabal of dissatisfied owners. And
squeaky wheel gets the oil.
Squeaky wheel, nothing. I mean, they're literally, the bearings are frozen. They're just wobbling along, and they're set. Almost invariably, it seems to me, there's that group, and they may have legitimate concerns at the very base of their dissatisfaction. But the problem is that a person you can reason with, a group like that, becomes very difficult in a public setting. It's almost a mob mentality. So now I believe, and I've certainly advised my clients, and I've been part of these meetings very often, well, maybe all too often, that the board has to get control of the situation. And before any meeting, and there are certain formalities and agendas that must be followed, but I think whoever's going to chair the meeting, be it the board president or some other member of the board, they need to set the guidelines, the behavioral guidelines for that meeting, and then to enforce them. I've had circumstances where I've had to remind people that, by the way, you're in a civil society. How about operating like that? You may have disagreements. Doesn't mean you need to be disagreeable, and you certainly don't have a right to take pot shots at the board because they happen to be the ones at the table. I've had to involve the police, believe it or not, where you get someone that absolutely will not behave in a meeting like that and disrupts it for their own agenda. That's the extreme, but I've had it in several times in my career where I've had to call the police in to remove them. It's not the way you want the community to run, but you do have to have some control, because like the question the questioner presents, a lot of people, you know, it's hard enough to be involved. But when you go to a meeting like that and you've got screaming and all kinds of vulgarity and incivility, people just, it's easier to sit in front of your TV and watch the news. You don't need to go to a meeting like that. So the board, it really does fall to the board, though. They're the governing body. They need to get control of it. I think setting up, again, at the beginning of meetings, behavioral or codes of conduct is essential to trying to get a hold of that. And to the extent that people refuse to comply with those codes, I think they have to be resolute in their enforcement of those rules.
So here's another situation.
Sure.
You've got a defaulting unit owner, and they're months and months behind in their common charge and special assessment payments, and you just learned that they filed for bankruptcy. Is the board prevented from collecting on the common charges because they filed for bankruptcy?
Well, initially, sure. I'm getting the sound, this is sounding familiar, but I see this a lot. The reality is that many people that have defaulted in their common charges are in financial dire straits. That's just a reality. So very often, one of the first things they stop paying is those common charges. The procedure is that once they've been turned over to the attorney for collection, certainly my office, we checked the bankruptcy rolls to see if anyone's filed. If they have filed, the moment they file their bankruptcy petition, what's called an automatic stay slams in place. That means that no collection efforts can take place. it's not a permanent circumstance. And condo associations have a unique benefit of having a having a super priority lien on these common charges so that they can go into court and then get that stay lifted. And that's a critical piece of information. So before anything can be done to proceed with collecting the common charges, you have to go to the bankruptcy court, ask the court for relief from that stay, and show that you've got a secured debt and that you intend to proceed to collect it. And the court, more often than not, very, very often, will grant that that relief. And then once you have the relief from stay, then you can start either with your demand letter or initiating a lawsuit or anything like that. So while bankruptcy is a temporary matter, it's not a permanent one that you have to be concerned about. You just have to know that the moment you understand there's a bankruptcy action, you cannot proceed with any collection until you get that relief.
So as a follow-up to that,
yeah.
So say if I'm in collections, and does that make me ineligible to run for a board seat on the condominium association? How does that work?
Well, it can, I suppose. And I've sort of gone back and forth on this. There is a statute that that permits associations to prevent the use of amenities and things like that to defaulting unit owners. Say if you have a pool or something like that, you can actually suspend their right to access to that pool while they're in default. You cannot stop them from voting or appearing at meetings, although the statute really doesn't speak to whether or not you can prevent them from running for the board. I think it's probably not a good idea if you're in default and you've decided to run for the board. It's likely to come out in the meeting that unless you've got a cabal of similarly non-payers, I think you're going to have a trouble getting elected. But I haven't seen anything in the statute that prevents you while you're in default. I'm concerned, and this may be a little editorial rather than from a legal perspective, though, that the absence of a prohibition in the statute could lead to abuses where you have sort of retributive fines being levied against certain troubled owners who are pressing the board to do certain things. There can be that sort of shenanigans, for lack of a better word. So while I don't generally advise my clients to use that as a reason for disqualifying people from running, I would simply say, you know, let the truth fly. If they're in default, let them explain why they're in default. And if people are willing to elect them anyway, then so be it.
And again, I'm talking to Ron Barba of Bender, Anderson & Barba. So we're getting towards the end here. So what do you do when you have just two unit owners who are next to each other and they're just bickering? Just, you know, whatever the reason might be. He's a smoker. You smell the smoke. Is there any way to stop that person from smoking? I mean, how do you resolve disputes like that?
Well, you can't. I mean, the truth is that the association's got they have certain obligations as an association, and they have certain rights as an association. They certainly have powers. But, for instance, a smoking situation. Smoking's not illegal. And unless it's in your declaration, and it must be, the prohibition must be in your declaration and the use restriction. If it doesn't say no smoking, then that person has a right to smoke. Now, that has its limitations. If the neighbor, for instance, has some sort of medical condition that is created as a result of that smoke finding its way into the unit, then there may be a need, again, under that Fair Housing Act, to provide some sort of reasonable accommodation. And the association should look to try to meet those needs. But you cannot regulate the lawful conduct of somebody inside their unit. By the same matter, you really can't legislate them into getting along. And where you have warring neighbors, you really have to certainly one of the things available to an association as a service to their owners is to offer them mediation. The statute certainly recognizes it. I know in my office we use that as a tool very often, to try to get them to try to get to the basic, not to their positions, but rather what's the cause of the conflict. Very often you can't solve the problem, but we try to at least facilitate a meeting to see if we can't get it. we remind them, by the way, is if their behavior becomes so problematic that they're disturbing others, that we're going to hold them accountable each for their acts, and they may be fined, and other acts actions could be taken. But you really touch on a real problem in communities, because sometimes living in close proximity, it invites this sort of conflict.
So anything else you want to discuss? Anything that you think we missed? Any pertinent information for listeners?
Well, I think that the key to a successful association and to a successful board is education. I know that the Connecticut Association, Community Association Institute of Connecticut, is a very active branch that supports education and communication for associations and the board members and unit owners. I absolutely commend that to anybody that's any of your listeners, because I think they can gain a lot. They have a lot of functions throughout the year. Having a property manager that knows what they're doing and has a good reputation for getting things done is key. There's an expense to that, but I think it's money well spent. Often, smaller associations, it may not make sense, but getting that sort of professional oversight is always a good thing. And of course, having an outstanding law firm is really the key. I may be blowing my own horn here, but like a good accountant, you want an attorney that actually spends their time knowing what the community association laws are like. It's a complex statutory scheme. It's not as simple as one statute. It is it's a combination of about four or five statutes. And unless you've got a lawyer that understands those interrelations, you're really behind the eight ball.
Understood. Ron, thank you for stopping by. I really learned a lot. You know, there's a lot of things that you just don't even consider. But really appreciate you stopping by and educating me and educating our listeners. Again, that was Ron Barba from Bender, Anderson, and Barba. Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Brian Forster. Please join me next week for more Ask the Experts here on The Talk of Connecticut.
Thanks, Brian.
Bender, Anderson, and Barba PC is in the unique position of being able to offer their clients proven solutions derived from the depth and breadth of their experience. They offer services for homeowner associations in the areas of general counsel, common fee collection and foreclosure, document revisions and amendments, rules enforcement, association borrowing, contract review, developer issues, construction defects litigation, and mediation and facilitation of meetings. Their best practices strategy delivers professional expertise to their clients in the most cost-effective manner possible. Bender, Anderson & Barba PC's extensive experience means that they have been exposed to a vast range of problems, which gives them the ability to anticipate problems and offer effective solutions. They promote community and responsible leadership in the associations they serve. We also educate our clients, preparing them to address the challenges of running an association. Call Bender Anderson and Barba PC at 203-248-6440. That's 203-248-6440.